Welcome to At Home with Herbs on KWRD 100.7 FM. This is Anne McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you today about all things herbal. Well, today, June 14th, is Flag Day, and so we're going to have a salute to Betsy Ross, the traditional creator of our first American flag, and all the other foremothers that went before us and managed the households while the forefathers were off creating a new country. We're going to be talking first a little bit in this segment about the gardening that they did and some of the herbs that they grew, the very, very early settlers. And then the second quarter, we'll in the recipe box, we'll talk a little bit about the bouquet garni, which is a technique of adding three or more herbs together to blend together in a dish and how you can use that in your cooking today. In the third section, I'm hoping to get to talking about the medicine chest that the early foremothers would have had to have around the house and some of the herbs that they use that we can still safely use at home to improve and maintain our health. And lastly, in the fourth section, I'm looking forward to talking to you about what I call a sweet savor, which would be potpourri and other scented mixes that were used traditionally by our early foremothers. But before we get started into the garden, I wanted to let you know that today I've got something special for callers. We have three vouchers from the Fort Worth Symphony, who's they're playing in the Fort Worth Botanic Gardens. This is the time of the year that they're doing their concerts in the gardens. And we have vouchers that we'll be drawing for all those who call into our program today. We have vouchers for Saturday, June 21st, which is their featured guest with the Fort Worth Symphony will be the Mingo Fish Trap, which does, according to this thing, gut bucket soul, Nolens grit down funk, and horn-fueled Motown pop. Sounds rather interesting. On Sunday, June 22nd, we have a pair of tickets available for Viva el Mariachi, which is the sound of the mariachi bands and as the heart and the soul of Mexico. And then we have a third voucher available in the drawing. Red Seagull will be be there with the Fort Worth Symphony on Sunday, June 29th. He's the official cowboy poet of Texas, and he brings the Western spirit to the Botanic Gardens. All these events will be outdoors at the Fort Worth Botanic Gardens in Fort Worth on University Avenue, just north of Interstate 30. And if you're interested in being in the drawing, call in today and see if we can get some phone calls later on in the show. Now, let's begin and step back in time to the very, very first Europeans to come here across the ocean to the United States. These were our foremothers and our forefathers coming across on the Mayflower and other ships. It was a long voyage. But one of the things that they would always bring with them was herbs, because herbs were essentially part of their survival kit in the New World. Herbs we think of today as something that's, shall we say, something nice to have. It enhances the flavor of food. It'll make our houses nice, sweeter smelling. But for the early settlers, it was much more than that. It also included medicines, because there wasn't a Walgreens nearby. There wasn't a CVS pharmacy or some of the other drugstores. They had to have whatever they needed for physic, for fragrance, or for flavor. So they brought a number of herbs with them to grow in the gardens that they created here in the New World. Now, gardens, I want to remind you, were a little more than just, they were definitely, as I said, part of their survival. But it was also, in some ways, the gardens and how they created their gardens indicated that they regarded a garden as almost a symbol of civilization. When I drove here from home, I went from one piece of civilization to another, from one city to another along a highway. I was not at all out of civilization at all. But these new homes, they were literally being carved out of the open wilderness there. Of course, there were the Native Americans there, but that's another story we won't get into. But the gardens, as they were orderly and they had a wall, and they were actually symbols of that order and civilization. So let's take a look at the information we have in a book that was written at the time of the first settlers. You know, if you were going in a far distant place, even if it's for a vacation, you'd probably pick up a travel guide. I know I have. When I first time I went overseas down to South America, I got myself a travel guide that showed the rules and regulations of the different countries. Well, if in this case, they were doing more than simply visiting somebody else's homes, they were actually going to a place where they were going to have to set up their own civilization and their own cities and their own towns from scratch. So they needed something that would help them know what they had to bring and what they could expect to find there. And a man named John Josselyn was clever enough to put together a book in 1672. I have a copy of it here. It's called New England's Rarities Discovered. And it's got this great picture on the front. It looks like a dragon, the sort of dragon you would have at the edge of the maps at those times. Here be dragons. Well, they were practically going to a place that, as far as they knew, might as well have had dragons. And this book was essentially a travel guide for them, or a survival guide. It tells them what they could find there, what they would have to bring for themselves. It gives detailed descriptions of some of the animals, you know, the raccoon, the porcupine I'm seeing here, the moose deer, the fox, and all the different animals they could expect, some of which would be adversaries and some of them which would be food. But part of what they have in here also is what could be grown in the New World. Obviously, the farmers that were going to be coming would want to know what kind of climate they were going to be dealing with, what they could grow there, and what they would need to bring with them. I wanted to read this to you because it's just an interesting insight into what our early settlers and our early foremothers had to look forward to when they came to these rocky shores. Now, remember, this was focusing on New England, so some of the comments about what grows and what doesn't would be certainly different in our Southwest area here in Texas. "Of such garden herbs as do thrive there, and of such as do not," says John Josselyn. "Cabbage grows there exceedingly well. Lettuce, sorrel, parsley, marigold," with a Mary, M-A-R-Y, "French mallows, chervil," a chervil is a relative of cilantro, "burnet, winter savory, summer savory, thyme, sage, carrots, parsnips of a prodigious size, red beets, radishes, turnips, purslane, wheat, rye, spearmint, rue," which will hardly grow, feather few or fever few, "prospereth exceedingly. Southern wood is no plant for this country, nor rosemary, nor bays. White satin grows pretty well, though doth so doth lavender cotton, but lavender is not for this climate. Pennyroyal, smallage, ground ivy or alehoof, gillyflowers, which will continue 2 years, hollyhocks, house leeks, coriander, comfrey with white flowers, dill, anise, clary," we call it clary sage, "never lasts but one summer. The roots rot with the frost. Asparagus thrives exceedingly, so does garden sorrel, and sweetbriar or eglantine. Bloodwort, but sorrily, but patience and English roses very pleasantly. Celandine, muchasa, dittener, or pepperwort flourishes notably, and so does tansy." Now, I'll stop there because it does go on to describe some of the others. One of the things you noticed in there is that it did mention some things we think of as vegetables. Well, that is because when they mentioned herbs, when they described herbs, it was any kind of soft plant, what we would call soft tissue plants. And most of what we would regard as vegetables, they would include actually in an herb garden. It was more of a vegetable and herb garden is the way we would look at it. Well, that's just a summary of some of the things that they would grow. And those things would be used for eating, and for making medicines, which we will be talking about in the third segment. When we come back in after the break, we'll be talking about how they use some of these in the kitchen. I wanted to remind you, if you're there, that we'll be taking some calls. So call in and you can be put in the drawing for the vouchers. And also, anyone who's interested in being a sponsor for this show, we have sponsorship information available as well. We'll take a break now. Welcome back to At Home with Herbs on KWRD 100.7 FM. And I apologize to my listeners. My call screener pointed out that during the last segment, I hadn't mentioned the phone number to call in. For everyone who calls this hour and gives us a question, we have vouchers to the Fort Worth Symphony's Concert in the Garden. So we'd sure like to hear from you and give away those tickets that we have. Okay, in the second half, or the second quarter of our show, we're going to be going into the recipe box. This is a show focusing on Flag Day and the herbs of our foremothers. And in the recipe box, we're going to be talking a little bit about how the early American women used herbs in their cooking. What were some of their techniques? Well, first of all, I've got to point out to you that they rarely used recipe books. If they had anything like a receipt book, which is what they called them, receipt books, it was something that was handwritten, perhaps a brief summary of some recipes they had learned from their mother or an aunt or a close friend. And it was handwritten and passed down from mother to daughter. Sometimes a receipt book would be created for a young woman when she got married. And this is something she would keep with her all of her married life. So printed recipe books like we're familiar with were not commonly available in the New World, not until after the Revolutionary War. So a lot of cooking was done just entirely from information that the cook had in her head. So she had to learn how to put herbs together to make things flavorful. And well, they had a very straightforward technique, which the French gave us a name, which we still sometimes use today, which is bouquet garni, which is translated, if you translate that, as sort of a bouquet, but a savory bouquet, a grouping of herbs, usually at least three, sometimes four and five, or depending on what you're cooking. Well, how did you put together a bouquet garni? First of all, it started out with a base flavor. Now, the thing that's most commonly used today would be like bay leaves. Bay leaves have a strong underpinning flavor. Our early settlers would have bay trees around there, despite what John Jocelyn said. The bay was able to grow in this area. And then they would add one of two families of herbs. The first family of herbs is what we know as botanists refer to as the mint family. But that doesn't mean that they just used mint. But herbs like thyme, oregano, basil, rosemary, those are plants that botanically are regarded as members of the same family as mint. Most of them have square stems and opposite leaves, and they have semi-woody stems from the base. But you would pick one of a member of the mint family. Let's, for example, say you were cooking fish. A good example would be to pull out of that family, I would say, would be thyme. Thyme is a relatively quiet herb, but it has a good flavor that would go with fish. So you'd have, say, bay leaf, and you'd add thyme to it. And then you had another set of herbs that you would you'd select something from. And that would be a members of the parsley family, or sometimes called the carrot family. These are plants where the leaves actually join more down at the base. And they, if you look underground, you'll find a lot of them have a long tap root, a central bottom root that reminds you something of a carrot. And it is members of the same family. Parsley is one. Now, the parsley that we use today is grown here in the United States primarily for the leaves. But there are some parsleys where it's bred for a thicker root. And the parsley, like parsnip, would be actually be cooked and eaten as well. The root could be used. Cilantro is also a member of that same family. That's a stronger flavor. But if you look at cilantro, the leaves, you know, come down to the base. They spring from the base, and the leaves actually of cilantro, in my opinion, look fairly like parsley. In fact, someday I'll tell you the tale of how I mix my parsley and cilantro up, but that's another story. Chervil is another one, a member of the same family. Chervil is not used as much now in the United States, but it was more commonly used then. It was in the list I mentioned in the last section. And John Jocelyn was describing the herbs that would grow here. Chervil would be grown. Dill and fennel. Those would be grown not only for the leaves, which we eat, and that would be good if you were cooking fish, as we started out here for our bouquet garni, but also the seeds, which would be used whole in baked goods, but they would also be ground and included in mixes. So you have a New England housewife who receives some fish that her husband caught nearby, and she would perhaps use a bay leaf and some thyme and some parsley. And then what she would do is take a bit of string and put the because she wouldn't, she'd take the fresh leaves from out of the out of the garden, and she would take a bit of string and she would tie it all together in what looked something like a very quick and easy bouquet. And this is what she would drop in the stew pot. And that would then could be retrieved out of the stew pot later after it had finished flavoring the food. That's where you get the bouquet garni ideas. It's a bouquet. It's all tied up together and you put it together. Now, of course, that's not the only combination that can be used. And let's talk a little bit about how you can use that today in your cooking, maybe something you're cooking for dinner tonight. Another possibility, for instance, would be to start maybe with a different strong flavor. For instance, black pepper. Now, black pepper, obviously, you can't tie up in part of the bunch, but we're sort of stretching it a bit here with a bouquet garni concept. And you take maybe black pepper and combine it, for instance, with maybe some basil and some parsley. And that combination you could use on, for instance, beef. That would be something I could see, some ground black pepper and maybe some of the dried basil, since you probably don't have, some of you probably don't have fresh basil available. If you have the fresh, that's even better. But the basil and some ground black pepper and some parsley mixed together, you could use that to rub on your meat as you were broiling it or grilling it, or if you're cooking it in the oven, or even you could take those three and add it to whatever sauce you were using to put on top of the meat. If you wanted to make like, for instance, a tomato sauce or a white sauce or something out of those famous red and white cans that all of us have from that famous soup company, you know, cream of mushroom soup, cream of celery soup. Well, you could take, say, cream of mushroom soup and add some of the basil and some ground pepper and some parsley together, mix it in well, and put that on your meat and put it on a an oven dish, put it in the oven and bake it as you otherwise would. That would be a good combination. Another possibility is, for instance, garlic with, say, rosemary and a little bit of the dill. Again, a different combination, a little stronger. But you can use the bouquet garni principle in grouping herbs together and how you cook today. And it gives you ability to add different things together and come up with the combinations that your family likes. Now, we'll be taking some calls after the break in a few minutes. I just wanted to remind you that if you can call at 1-800-949-5973, that's 1-800-949-5973. Anyone who calls in today will be going into a drawing for some tickets to the Fort Worth Botanic Gardens Concerts in the Garden. And I really, I'd love to have some of these tickets myself. So you call in, and if you have a question or a comment, I'll be happy to talk with you. But let's go back for a moment to the recipe box and take a quick look at something that I have in the cookbook that I was mentioning in the advertising, the Urban Cowgirl Bakes, which is available on my website. One of the things I have in there is, for instance, eggnog bread or flesh lemon balm bread. These are different recipes that would have been made in some cases by those foremothers, those early foremothers, like the spicy shaker apple cake. Here's a good one that is essentially a coffee cake with a nice helping of applesauce and some of the cinnamon and allspice and nutmeg that our foremothers enjoyed and we enjoyed as well. So that's available on my website for $9 each. My website is www.ann-mccormick.com. And give us a call also here if you want to give us a call so we can take your call after the break in another moment. And I just want a reminder, if you have a business that you'd like to be a sponsor of this show, you can call in. We'll be happy to give you information as well. Well, I hope you're having a good day. I'm certainly enjoying being here and chatting with you about herbs. And we're just about to take a break now. This is Ann McCormick, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to At Home with Herbs on KWRD 100.7 FM. This is Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you about all things herbal. We'll be happy to take your calls later on in this segment. Right now, we're going to talk about the medicine chest. The medicine chest that our early foremothers would have needed to keep in their home to keep their families happy and healthy. This is Flag Day, and this is part of a salute to our foremothers. Those are the ladies that kept the family going and the farm running while the forefathers were off building a new country. Well, what did our foremothers need to have in their medicine chest? Well, they needed anything that would be required to handle aches and pains and bruises and sniffles and a lot of things that we oftentimes go to the doctor. Well, the doctor might not have been anywhere nearby and might not have had much in the way of pharmaceuticals himself. So the woman would have to be prepared for that. So we're going to go over some of the uses for some of the common herbs that you're familiar with today and how they were used not only in the kitchen, but to improve the health of the family. Now, the food itself, having this herbs in it, that in itself was considered sometimes part of the health process. The concept of what we, I don't know if you've heard the term nutraceuticals, which has floated around the last 10 years. The idea is that the things that we eat for nutrition can also be medicines as well. Well, that's not a new concept. Our foremothers would have looked at us and said, well, of course, why not? You know, you if you have somebody who has a cold, you want to give them stimulating and warm foods. If you have somebody who has a fever, you want to give him something that will cool him down and put his body back in balance. So using foods to aid in the health was just a normal part of how they handled everyday life. But let's now talk a moment about some of the specific herbs that they used and what they used them for. Sage. Now, sage is one that we use in stuffing, especially at Thanksgiving, and when we're cooking poultry. But sage was regarded as almost a silver bullet for your health. If you ate sage regularly, it would almost guarantee long life. It was there was an old European proverb: "Is why should a man die if he has sage in his garden?" Which shows their confidence in sage as something of being a health builder. Sage was definitely one that they would use for that. And that was part of the reason they would also include it with the foods that they would eat. Thyme. Thyme, such a small herb, was used and still is today in preparations to take care of problems in the mouth and the throat and to clean and repair the mucous membranes in the mouth and the throat. If you had sores in your throat, gargle with thyme and probably with sage, actually, would be a good combination. Actually, you probably used some of that this morning when you picked up your mouthwash. If you take a look at the back of the bottle the next time you're in the bathroom, you'll look at the ingredients, and one of them will be thymol, T-H-Y-M-O-L. Well, that's an extract of the chemical that is principally found in thyme. So we still use that today. Well, another one that they use that we would also think about perhaps would be mint. Now, mint, it's a bright, strong flavor, and we enjoy it in desserts and in teas. But mint is still used, and as it was then, for stomach disorders. It's good for an after-dinner beverage. If you had eaten too many fatty foods, mint is good for the stomach. And that's certainly how they would use it. It was regarded as a warming herb, something to stimulate the appetite as well. If you had someone who was ill and was disinclined to eat, giving them some mint would be a way to stimulate their appetite. Now, another thing they would be growing in their garden for the medicine chest would be roses. Roses, you say. Why would they grow roses? Well, they're lovely and they have a beautiful scent. But rose water was used in cooking, and roses were the rose scent and the rose flavor was regarded as a soothing and calming herb. It would be included in foods for someone who, for instance, was hysterical or had a bad shock. You would give them something with rose water in it. The rose hips were also used. And those of you who are interested in natural herbal medicines will also know that we now know that rose hips are relatively high in vitamin C. So that was something that was a restorative to the body and would also help in the general health. So rose hips would be collected and saved and put in the medicine chest. Another herb that we don't use much today because it got a bad rap about 10, 12 years ago was comfrey. Comfrey was traditionally known as the bone herb. In fact, the German word for comfrey is Bohnenkraut, which translates directly as bone herb. It was used for healing bones and bruises. If you had a bad fall, or maybe while Dad was chopping down the trees to clear the lands, something had fallen on his foot and sprained his ankle, comfrey tea would be given to him, and they would put a poultice on the leg, comfrey poultice, because it was good. And it's been demonstrated that it is indeed very helpful in healing bruises, and taken internally, it will aid in the repair and knitting of the bones. So that's one they would definitely be growing. Now, I'm sure if you've been listening over the last 10 years about herbal medicine, you would have heard about comfrey. And there was a great fuss and to-do about comfrey being able to damage the liver. That was true if it was taken regularly and over long periods of time. But for short periods, it is regarded by most herbalists as being safe. But of course, with anything like that, you definitely would need to consult with your doctor before taking comfrey as a medicine. So what else would our foremother grow in her garden for the medicine chest? Well, another one, of course, would be poppy. The Asian poppy that we actually get codeine from and other things, which are morphine, codeine, and a variety of pain-killing medicines, they would have poppy juice available so that they could use that in extreme situations. Again, a badly broken bone or a serious fall, or someone who was dealing with a very painful illness. So poppies would be grown. Chamomile, on the other end of the spectrum, would be something they would grow for soothing, relaxing teas. Again, they had stress just as much as we do, and they would have enjoyed a nice cup of chamomile, for instance, near the bedtime to help soothe, calm the mind, and prepare it for sleep. Some of the other herbs that they would grow. Well, they would grow some that we would not really grow to use for medicine at home. One good example is foxglove. Foxglove leaves are used to make a digitalis, which we still use in our pharmacopoeia today. But digitalis is a dangerous drug. It is, if not administered properly. And so definitely avoid trying to dose yourself with foxglove. But that's one that they certainly would have grown and had available. That's probably one that they would talk to a qualified herbalist or the doctor to help them with that. And of course, they did find a few herbs here in the United States that they discovered. One of them was echinacea, which they learned about from the Indians. Another one is called Joe Pye weed, which is an odd name. Joe Pye was actually an American Indian who was well known to the early settlers, and he was the one that introduced them to this particular plant, which was used as sort of a keel-all for almost anything. And of course, then sassafras, which was found in the American South, but even tobacco, which we think of as simply something that you smoke for the pleasure of it, was used medicinally. So that concludes just a summary of some of the things in the medicine chest that our early foremothers would have grown in their walled gardens here in the New World. Well, after we come back from the break in another 60 seconds, I'll be happy to take your calls if you want to ask me about early American gardens or today's garden, how you would grow different things, something from the medicine chest or into cooking. We hope to talk to you soon. Welcome back to At Home with Herbs on KWRD 100.7 FM. This is Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you about all things herbal. Give us a call at 800-949-5973, and we'll be happy to take your calls and talk about herbs with you. Looking forward to hearing from you. In this fourth segment, though, before we get some calls, I wanted to talk about another aspect of herbs, and our salute to our foremothers. Today is Flag Day, June 14th. And as part of celebrating Flag Day, I've been talking about different ways that our foremothers used herbs as medicine, how they grew it in the garden, and what they did in the kitchen. We talked for a moment or two about creating a bouquet garni and how you can use that to season your foods today. Well, in this segment, we're going to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is a sweet savor, or what most of us would know today as potpourri. Potpourri. Well, there's all sorts of things that can go into potpourri. And potpourri is just a sort of the French word for something that smells interesting, although I should be a little more specific here. Potpourri, translated literally, means rotten pot. Now, that doesn't sound very sweet at all. But originally, potpourris are combinations of different herbs and flowers were put together in a moist mixture, actually. It was a moist potpourris. The dry potpourris came later. But we're going to talk about some of the ways that you can make potpourri with some of the herbs that grow in your garden, just as your foremothers did. Now, potpourris were used in sweet bags. That's what the more common name that they would call sweet bags. A sweet bag could be stored in the linen closet, in between the sheets. You could hang it in the wardrobe. They didn't have closets as much in earlier times, or what we would use in a closet. You could hang it on the hangers in the closet. A sweet bag would contain a lovely scented mix that would be put together. Now, a good potpourri is made up of three basic things. One is your botanicals, your flowers, your seeds, your leaves that have their smell, the original, like lavender buds, rose petals, patchouli leaves. These have a scent of their own. You would mix those together, and then you would include in it some sort of an essential oil. That would be extracted, a scented oil extracted from other plants. It could be something as simple as the extract of rose petals that you could then use to further enhance a potpourri made with roses, or it could be extract of something else, perhaps something more exotic. But the essential oils, and then the third thing that's in a really good potpourri is what's known as a fixative. And a fixative is a material that doesn't have a lot of smell of its own, a lot of scent of its own, but it grabs onto the essential oils, holds them, and then slowly releases them out into the air as time goes on. So a good mixture would have those three things. So you can make potpourris yourself. And there's a couple of interesting recipe groups I've got that I thought I would point out to you. One of the simplest for making potpourri is rose petals and lavender buds. It looks pretty. It smells lovely. And it's just easy to put together. You can mix those together and have it in a glass jar that look pretty in the living room or in the boudoir or the bathroom. And then when you want to release the scent into the air, you just lift the lid off of the jar. Now, I say to lift the lid off the jar. If you leave it in a bowl that looks pretty in the Home and Garden magazines with these open bowl of this different potpourri, if you just leave it open in a bowl, you're going to lose that scent, and you'll be actually lose the majority of the scent in about 2 weeks. So if you want to keep the scent for a long period of time, cover it up when you're not in the room. open it up and enjoy it in the room. And as you leave the room, that was what your great-great-grandmothers and your foremothers did. Enter the room, open the jar, leave the room, close the jar, so that you enjoy the scent while you're there and it isn't just releasing into the air at a time when nobody's there to enjoy it. Well, that's one of the simpler potpourries. But then you could also take that same basis, rose petals and lavender, and really spice it up. And you can add some of the spicier things that we think of as food spices, but they would smell wonderful in a potpourri. Anise seed from Far East, cloves, nutmeg, and cinnamon, especially if it's a mix you were looking to use in the fall and into the holidays. We associate as the smell of cloves, nutmeg, and cinnamon a lot with the holidays. And your foremothers would have actually had that. I know that sounds like they certainly couldn't grow it locally, but it was available by a clipper ship from the Far East. At this point, the British East India Company was bringing spices to Great Britain and to its colonies, which would, of course, include in the United States. And, of course, allspice, which was a native of Caribbean, that would be available. And later on, not long after the Revolutionary War, you would have actually nutmeg grown in the Caribbean, so it would have been readily available, too. But those are ones that you could add into an herb mixture to make a spicy potpourri and a sweet savor. Well, that's just one of the different ways that our foremothers would have used herbs. And we wanted to conclude today's show of our salute to our foremothers and Flag Day with a little something I found, or actually my husband found for me, that I think would be really worthwhile for us all to remember on here on Flag Day. I am your flag. Traditionalists say I was born of a woman's hand, fashioned from bits of colored cloth by a seamstress, one of our foremothers, in a small house in Philadelphia, a year after the new country was born. Historians are less certain of my origin, yet no one doubts my existence. I was created out of necessity to serve as the emblem of a people whose experiment in nationhood was as unique as the arrangement of my stars and stripes. I have proved my adaptability to change. I've accommodated growth. I've stood up to time and troubles. I fluttered in the fall air with George Washington at Yorktown. My fabric was shredded by cannonballs from British frigates in the War of 1812, and I was carried in triumph by Andy Jackson at New Orleans. The British could see me clearly in the mists of dawn's early light waving from the standards at Fort McHenry. I've witnessed turmoil and bitterness, even lost some of my glory in mid-century in a civil war between brothers, but I was later restored. I've traveled west with the new frontier. I flew from the headlamps of the Iron Horse in Utah. I was with the prospectors at Sutter's Mill, with the cavalry against cattle rustlers, and with the Rough Riders at San Juan Hill. I was with brave GIs storming the beaches at Normandy. I was raised over a shell-pocked hilltop at Iwo Jima, and I stood by the grim-faced negotiators at Panmunjom. I was on that last helicopter from Saigon and with the men and women of Operation Desert Storm. And finally, I was raised over the rubble of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I've been folded smartly by soldiers and handed to weeping widows. I've covered the coffins of those who've served country and community. I also decorate bandstands and concert halls. I'm saluted in parades and schools and at ballparks. I am part of our political process, high holidays and ice cream socials. I fly from skyscrapers and bungalows. I've been to the moon and the ocean floor. There are now more stars in my blue field than there were in the beginning, and if need be, there's room for more. But those red and white stripes remain as they always remained, clearly visible through the struggle, the symbol of the land of the free and the home of the brave. I am your past. I am your future. I am your flag. Well, happy Flag Day and happy salute to our foremothers. I look forward to talking to you next week on The Urban Cowgirl. We're going to talk about Midsummer Madness, herbal traditions and that are common available at the midsummer, which is June 21st. We'll talk about fruit dishes and the shifting sunlight in your garden. This is Ann McCormick, the Urban Cowgirl, wishing you happy herbing.